You're listening to the Inverse Podcast, where we explore how the scriptures can turn our world upside down,
or how it can be weaponized to uphold the status quo. I'm Drew Hart.
And I'm Jared McKenna, and this is Inverse.
Friends, I'm so excited for our conversation today. You are really going to appreciate it. We've got a wonderful friend and guest with us here in the studio. We've got the one and only Carla Mendoza Arana. She is a grassroots theologian, speaker, writer, and artist. She's from Lima, Peru, and has lived in the United States for nearly 24 years. As an Afro-Peruvian woman who continues to face displacement, her work revolves around exploring illegality, citizenship, and Latinidad. Carla is currently a student of liberation theologies at Union Theological Seminary in Lenape Land, commonly known as New York City. If you don't find her reading, then you're going to find her dancing to Bad Bunny. we're so grateful for our friend, one who's been on the journey with us here in Inverse, and also one who I've often called cousin, Carla, to join us for this conversation. Carla, welcome to Inverse Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's so good to see all of you.
Carla, this is a real joy. We've known just how significant your life and witness is for a long time, and it's so exciting to realize that others are catching on to that as well. We're so excited about this season of your life at Union, those beautiful windows that are behind you right now and all the history that's contained there. And something special happened at Union that you were a part of this last week. So I thought, as a way of kind of introducing your current studies in liberation theologies at that historic institution, would you invite us into this last week and what you participated in?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was on Tuesday. This is actually kind of funny. I was in class all morning and I knew that we were going to have an important chapel. And so I'm waiting for the clock. Like, I have to go because I need a good seat. And I walk into chapel, I'm rushing, you know, I'm like, and it's not like anybody else was competing with me. I just needed to sit where I wanted to sit. I walk in and the dean of chapel comes up to me and says, "Hey, I hate to put you in the spot, but will you be willing to read the scripture today?" And so I'm thinking like, two verses, you know, what? That's fine. And then she says, "It's Isaiah 53. And I'm like, "Okay, what part of Isaiah 53? And she says, "The entire thing." I say, "Oh, okay, well, give me 2 seconds to read the entire chapter to make sure that I know what I'm saying." And then she says, "Great, I'll put your name on the program, you know?" And so I pull up the program also to keep up and to know when I'm going up. And then I pull up the program and I see, and I knew, of course, that Dr. Mitri Rahab was going to be speaking. But then I look at the program and I see all of these names of people that I admire and have learned from for so long, you know, including Dr. Cornell West, who I'm actually taking a class with currently, which is, you know, has been incredible. And so I'm looking at this screenshot of the program and I'm looking at my name and I'm looking at their names and I just could not believe, you know, because, and you know, we'll get a little bit into who, you know, my story. But knowing like where I have been in spaces that were so oppressive and so, not even just to me, but to, you know, these are some of the systems that oppress the entire world. And then to look at my name in a space where these are the folks who are like pushing and have been pushing for so long for the liberation of all peoples, you know?
Yeah. When I saw that online, I was like, "Woo, go ahead. Come on, Carla. Come on. Let's go. You know, just, you know, Serene Jones, Cornel West, right? You know, just like, that was really awesome to see that. I was really excited for you. Holy jealous, right? So I was like, "Oh, that's that." To be in that space at that moment, I'm sure was really a joy. That was really cool.
Well, it was also so beautiful because for years I have been wanting to meet Dr. Mitri Rahab. And but I knew, you know, like I couldn't leave the country. I knew the situation in Palestine was very, you know, it has been for a long time, even before 2023. And so I just remember thinking, like, I would love to meet this person. And then he was just there. And afterwards, we, a group of us, got to have lunch with him and just sit with him, ask him questions. It was just like a very, like, I just felt very loved by Creator, you know? Where it was like this person who changed the ways that I understood the framework of what was happening in Palestine and the nation state of Israel. Like, it just like really mattered to me. Yeah, the moment he started speaking, I was already crying, which, you know, was a very theological conversation, but I was just very moved.
That's beautiful.
I once found myself in a conversation with Reverend Tracy Blackman and Dr. Cornel West, and Rev Tracy was talking about that she was going to meet the Pope and that she was nervous. And I joked with her, I wonder if the Pope is nervous to meet the famous Rev Tracy. And in the same way, I have no doubt that you ministered to those whom you deserve to be among, Carla. So that's why we're so excited for you.
Thank you. That's so good.
So Carla, you know that for Inverse, one of the things that we love to do is to set the stage with a particular passage, right? A biblical passage that can kind of shape maybe in the background some of our conversation that we can come back to later. So what biblical passage have you picked for us to consider today? And can you read that for us?
Yes, for sure. Let me pull it up. I have it right here. I have picked Luke 7, 36 to 50. And I'm going to skip the title because I think I have lots of thoughts. So I'll start. One of the Pharisees asked Jesus to eat with him, and he went into the Pharisee's house and took his place at the table. And a woman in the city who was a sinner, having learned that he was eating in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster jar of ointment. She stood behind him at his feet, weeping, and began to bathe his feet with her tears and to dry them with her hair. Then she continued kissing his feet and anointing them with the ointment. Now, when the Pharisee who had invited him saw it, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what kind of woman this is who is touching him, that she is a sinner. Jesus spoke up and said to him, Simon, I have something to say to you. Teacher, he replied, speak. A certain creditor who had two debtors, one owed 500 denarii and the other 50. When they could not pay, he canceled the debts for both of them. Now, which of them will love him more? Simon answered, I suppose the one for whom he canceled the greater debt. And Jesus said to him, you have judged rightly. Then turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, do you see this woman? I enter your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has bathed my feet with her tears and dried them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which were many, have been forgiven. Hence, she has shown great love. But the one to whom little is forgiven loves little. Then he said to her, your sins are forgiven. But those who were at the table with him began to say among themselves, who is this who even forgives sins? And he said to the woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. The word of the eternal one.
Amen.
Thanks be to God. Wow. What a text. Well, Carla, before we jump into that, let's jump into your story some. When do you first remember encountering the Bible?
I remember being 5 years old and being given a children's Bible. I remember the cover, it's bright yellow with an image in the middle. And it would have been an image from, you know, one of the Bible stories. This Bible still exists. I gave it to my cousin, who then gave it to my grandma. who then, and my grandma gave it to my mom. And so my mom still has this Bible.
Wow, that's beautiful.
And actually, I even might have been younger than five because I don't think I could read. So I would have been like 4 or 5. But I asked to be read this Bible so much that I just memorized each page. And so I would bring it along and I would read it to people, quote unquote. And so everyone thought I could read, but I couldn't. I just memorized every page.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's really cool. It's interesting when you think about like first Bibles, right? And I don't know, I guess we all have memories of what our first Bibles were. I'm curious, as you're thinking about those early experiences encountering, I mean, you're talking even some of pre-literate stage, right? Before you're actually reading it yourself. As you remember early stages of encountering the Bible, did you experience it as a liberating text, as an oppressive text, healing, harmful, something else, both? what were your encounters with the Bible as you reflect on those kind of memories that you had and how maybe it was being engaged in your community?
It was interesting because I think when looking back specifically as a kid, I love reading the Bible because I am a very visual person. And so I could picture the stories happening.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of like in my head, it was like I could see it all played out. And I was very, you know, my parents were both pastors. And so I watched, you know, Bible cartoons. And so in my head, it was kind of like, oh, I've seen this character, so I will read the stories. And it was so easy to imagine what was happening. Mm-hmm. And so I think there was like a playfulness to that. But also, you know, like reading some of the, maybe a little more, what word would I use? In some ways violent, you know, but wild stories of the Bible, like, you know, like the imagine a kid picturing all of these soldiers drowning in the Red Sea, you know? And so, so I think of some of those tensions, I'm sure, you know? But then also, I remember when I was 9 years old or 10 years old, I was given an actual Bible, and in between I had been giving like different versions of the kids' Bible, but when I was 10, they gave me a real Bible and, I still own this Bible. I still have it. And so I think it is in that time where I kind of started internalizing a lot of ideas of justice, but it was a very punitive God because it's, you know, like as a kid, you're not understanding that there's different genres in the Bible. There's different methods of writing. You just see it as it is, you know? But that idea of justice was very much in me. And I think it's because I had always had been faced with different kinds of bullying, you know, like as a kid. And so there was like that sense of like, it's okay if you mess with me because somebody else is going to mess with you, you know, because clearly God is on my side. Right. Yes. You know, which is like, yeah, you know, there's a lot of things there. And then in some ways it was just so comforting, you know, to read the stories of Jesus, to read the way that he interacted with people. I grew up in a very, I think maybe like our class, like our social class changed throughout my my life. And so there were times where my parents would have been considered middle class. And then there were times where we were poor, you know? And so I think in that there was like that, those stories, right, of the multiplying of the food and seeing that in our real lives, you know, like it was like, oh yeah, no, we wouldn't eat if this food wasn't being multiplied or if somebody hadn't shown up to provide, you know, and it would be kind of like miraculous, like there'd be nothing in the fridge kind of thing. And so in a lot of that, for me, it wasn't hard to believe because I had read so many biblical stories for so long. And then, you know, like growing up, I did grow up in a non-denominational space, which really means white evangelical, but in Spanish, you know, it was just translated. It was just translated. It was just translated white evangelicalism. And so I think it is then maybe that I started facing some of the more oppressive interpretations of the Bible, you know, especially as a teenager, and all the rules of purity culture, all the rules of a punitive God, which then, you know, it was kind of hard to argue against.
Purity culture, punitive God, penal substitutionary atonement. It's a package, yes. Right? Carla, there is hints at what you've shared so far that kind of point to some of your particular context that shapes who you are and your work in ministry. We would love to have you invite us into what lenses out of your own experience, to whatever degree you wish to share about your own experiences, has helped shape your reading of the scriptures in ways that are liberative, that might be of assistance to others who maybe share that unholy trinity, which we just named, and are seeking something that feels a little bit more like the liberating love that we do see in Jesus.
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in Lima, Peru, and from a young age, I experienced the joy of Blackness and then also the resistance of people to Blackness. Also because my dad is a Black Peruvian man and my mom is a white Peruvian woman. And so, but I knew I was Black, and you know, a lot of Peruvian culture actually is Black, especially in the coast and especially in the parts where I live. Even though it's still kind of hush hush, like we don't talk about it, there's a commodification of Blackness in that way. And so, yeah, so I knew that. And then I grew up, you know, as a pastor's kid. Both of my parents were pastors at the time. Grew up going mostly to private Christian schools, which also meant evangelicalism. And then in the years between 2000 and 2001, something shifted for our family, which was that my dad moved to the United States because that economic situation in Peru. This is in the middle of Fujimori, back in the 90s. Well, even like some of the 80s, but 90s and 2000s. And so, you know, my dad, a pastor, chemical engineer, teacher, could not find a job. A musician, and just could not find a job. But he had visited the United States before, you know, so he says, I'm going to move there. And my parents say, if within a year, you know, me, my sister, and my mom can't get a visa, we're not, my dad is coming back to Peru because we cannot be separated. And so after a year, miraculously, we get our visas. Exactly on the day, actually. My dad left on December 14th, 2000, and we arrived on December 15, 2001. And so, but in that process of moving to the United States, we became undocumented. And so that, and now currently we're a multi-status family. I'm the only person in my family who is undocumented. And so, and I know, you know, like given the political atmosphere of the United States, there is kind of conversation that's been had on whether somebody should say that out loud in public these days. But so much of the ways that I write and the ways that I live my life, and even the ways that I, absolutely the ways that I understand scripture, are from this worldview of illegality and kind of always struggling with it. And so I am okay with still saying this publicly. and I think, of course, like I've changed sometimes in the ways that I share that, but but being a child and internalizing illegality is very interesting, because then there is, you know, especially like with therapy and all the work that I've done, there is that sense of like, is my being illegal? But that doesn't make sense with the idea that everything that God created is good. And so how can something that is good be illegal? And so I, you know, and I grew up, and then also like moving to the United States meant changing even the ways that I identify. If I said I was Black, people would say, no, you're not. You are Latina. And I would be like, but I'm Black. I am a Black girl at the time, right? Like, I'm a Black woman. And I just could never, even if I said, like, oh, but I'm also American because I'm South American, I'd be like, no, there's only one America. So I'm like, okay, well, I grew up thinking that I was American, so... you know, so many things like that, that really changed, my social location changed drastically from one day to the other. You know, the language barrier, all those things. So then I find myself in the United States. My parents are looking for, I mean, you know, I'm a child, so I'm a teenager. And my parents end up in a Spanish-speaking Black and brown Pentecostal church. And I could not, like, my brain couldn't compute in a way, you know, because what I was looking for in church was a non-denominational white evangelical church. That translates because that's what I thought was church, you know. And so I really struggled there. I'm so grateful that I spent time there. And of course, some of the theologies and beliefs of those systems are also not, you know, not liberatory, but I learned a lot, especially even culturally. I think it created a space where I could speak Spanish, I could listen to the music I wanted to listen to, all those things, you know. And of course, the whole like immigrant community, right? Like there are people there who are also experiencing illegality, who are also, you know, have left their families, who miss their grandmas, who miss, you know, like that feeling is like a very, it's one is very profound, but it's also a very lonely experience, because there's a difference of somebody saying, I miss my grandma who lives, you know, 2 hours away, and I miss my grandma who lives thousands of miles away, and I cannot go because there is an actual border separating us. In my case, multiple borders. And so, you know, and then being like, oh, yeah, I just haven't seen her since last year. And maybe like, I haven't seen my grandma in 20 years, you know? And so that kind of idea, that what I was really held in those spaces in the Spanish speaking Black and brown Pentecostal church. But then I became a young adult, and somebody invites me to a college group, and guess what it is? You won't believe it. A white evangelical group. But I didn't know that. I just thought it was church. I said, this is how church works, you know, from the music to the, I mean, the order of the service, everything. The music, the, you know, the announcements, the sermon, everything, you know? And I was like, this is how I grew up. And I couldn't explain it to my parents, but I also didn't know that it was just translated evangelicalism. So I spent a lot of time in those spaces, but I remember in 2014, something happened. Well, one, the murder of Tamir Rice happened in Cleveland, Ohio. And I'll never forget it. He was a kid, actually a child. And that really struck me, and I didn't know how to voice that to anybody. But also I knew that something was deeply wrong, and I felt like, I was, you know, I remember thinking, I just feel so proud in the ways that, like, but in a bad way, like there's like a pride here about the ways that I know the Bible. And I did know the Bible. I had read the Bible multiple times from beginning to end. And then one day in my, I don't know, maybe it was my naiveness, maybe it wasn't. But one day I decide, and also, you know, in the mix of all of that, there's a lot of charismatic things happening, you know, because I had been Pentecostal for a little bit. And then, you know, so the charismatic church wasn't far off from me. And so I don't know, maybe it was my naiveness. Maybe it really was that I, you know, the Holy Spirit, I don't know. But I said, Spirit, I have a favor to ask. Can you delete the Bible from my brain? And then I was committed to the idea that it was. And so I said, I only need one verse. And it was, let me not, you know, in the Psalms where David says, I have kept your word in my heart that I might not sin against you. I said, that's all I need to know, but I don't need to know it in my brain. I need a reset. Something is wrong here. And so then when people, you know, I was doing youth ministry at the time, and you know, teenagers have a lot of questions, and they would be like, Carla, You know, what does the Bible say about whatever, marriage, about anything? And a week before, I would have been like, I know exactly what the Bible says about this. And then I did not know. I said, I don't know. Let me get back to you. I have to think about this, you know? And so I don't, you know, yeah, it was maybe like a combination, right, of trust and naiveness and all those things. But once I pray that prayer, every idea that I had, every system that I had about who God was, it all started crumbling down, and I didn't know what to do. You know, so I mean, I had a bit of an unraveling there, but because you know, like, all this is who I thought God was, and then and then I didn't know who God was. And in so many ways, you know, as somebody who was experiencing illegality, that was the only certainty I had, was who God was. And now I had no certainty. And so even like now, it's making me teary, you know, of like thinking of that moment. But then that uncertainty is what led me to the most beautiful God, you know, who is a God who cares for the oppressed, who cares for those who experience marginalization, who cares for Black people, who cares for Indigenous people. And not only that, it was like God is a liberator God. And that really changed something in me, you know, but it was a long road.
Wow. That's really powerful and beautiful. And I mean, I'm just thinking about all those, I mean, from, I mean, your journey was engaging a lot of things, Blackness, right? Even just, I mean, you spent a little bit of time, but as a fellow PK, that's a whole world in and of itself. But the questions of illegality for me are really significant ones that both touch to certainly my own family and tradition and things like that, but also, and this is what I've been reminding, especially younger Black folk, Black Americans that that maybe don't know their history as well, and so are not grasping parts of our own story to share in empathy and walking alongside other communities as well. Like these questions of illegality are central for what it has meant to be Black in this world, right? And so if we forget our own experiences, it will close us off, and we may end up repeating some of the same things that were done to us under the name of law and order, right? And so, huge. I'm really curious. So you said a lot. I could go on and on about your journey, influences the Pentecostal Brown Church as a break, right? An escape from the translation of white evangelicalism, the reset, the uncertainty and embracing that, all of that. I'm really curious how all of those things come together for how you actually then will read a text like Luke, you know, how Luke 7, 36 to 50 opens up maybe when you bring all of that insights to read these texts anew. So I'd love for you to guide us into conversation around this text. What are you seeing, and how can we kind of dialogue around this together?
Yeah, absolutely. So, so recently, you know, and of course, in the time of this recording, we're in the week where Lent is starting. But before Lent starts, there is Mardi Gras, you know. And recently, with a very dear friend, we kind of hosted a little Mardi Gras chapel. And the topic of the conversation was the baby dolls of Mardi Gras, which is a tradition that happens in I always say New Orleans, but I know that I'm pronouncing it wrong. New Orleans. It's the Midwestern. It's the Midwestern side of me.
Everyone gets it wrong unless you're from Louisiana, so it's all right. Yes.
But it is the tradition of Black women who celebrate themselves, who honor who they are, and they also in that way are honoring the Orishas, because each dress and Yeah, the different rituals that happen during Mardi Gras are referencing different orishas. And so, but I was thinking a lot about them and in connection to this text, in connection to the experience of this woman and the experience of Black women. Because the reason why it's specifically for this celebration, Black women dress in bright colors, in almost in, I mean, they look like outfits that baby dolls would wear. And so specifically for this, there is like a reclaiming of femininity, of sensuality, of even girlhood, you know, which a lot of times Black women are not afforded girlhood. And so, but also they, the original tradition is that the women who first began dressing as baby dolls were sex workers. And there is a kind of a tradition of believing that the woman in this text was a sex worker. But I also think about the ways that we never really know what the sin is. You know, there is a tradition of that idea, but Jesus doesn't say that. Text doesn't say that. You know, so there's kind of like a wondering of what is the sin. And so, but when I was reading this, I specifically was struck by the idea of Jesus kind of like shutting things down a little bit, you know, and just, it's like, well, what did you do? You know, like, I came in here and you didn't do anything, you know, and this is a religious leader who has power in the community, as much power as he could have had within the Roman Empire, right? But he says, you didn't do the things that needed to be done. But this woman comes in and I'm struck by how she interrupts everything, because I'm assuming Jesus is around, right? Like Jesus is walking here, walking there, hanging out with people here, hanging out with people there. But she specifically interrupts the social norms for this moment in time. You know, she says, you need to stop for me. I'm walking into this room. And I'm going to do what I need to do to get to Jesus. You know?
No, that's so good. That's so, yeah, the disruption of the norms, right, is so huge that she, I've heard people say that she makes her own path, right, to Jesus. That wasn't available in that moment otherwise. If she had just played proper, right, in terms of the social customs of the day, then there's no access for her in that moment. So she literally creates a pathway to Jesus that I think is profound, the courage to do that. Yeah, that's so good.
Yeah, and I also was thinking about how she, and because, I, you know, of course I'm thinking from the context of a Black woman, in, you know, and I'm not saying that she was Black, I'm just saying that that's how I read the text, because it's my experience, you know? And I think of all the ways that people have, and even more than that, society has made Blackness to be a sin, and then and has made being a woman being a sin. And so it's more of like this woman is interrupting a lot of things, and how Black women interrupt the social norms to say, we're not, you know, we're not sinful. We are going to be who we need to be in order to get to liberation.
That's good. And how, I mean, the power to categorize someone as sinful, right? Who gets to decide that? Who gets to, from the outside, define someone else's essence and being, right? And I think that's so profound that that's what they were trying to do to this woman, the label, and make it stick. And it was sticking, right, for everyone else, except for Jesus and her, right? It's sticking, and it's shaping how people are seeing her and interacting with her in that moment.
And sticking in a way that isn't merely an individualist culture, but a collectivist culture. So her sin is actually dragging all of us down. And what it is to find people to blame in situations of oppression, rather than actually uplifting the oppressed and challenging those systems of oppression. Like they're surely part of the dynamics that both Jesus and her are aware of as she crashes this party and Jesus's table manners on show, wrecking Pharisees' parties. But what I find particularly fascinating with what you were just sharing, Carla, is if we pull it back one verse prior to the title that you didn't want to read because it wrongly frames, and partly knowing that those titles were inserted later, but there's a flow in this text. And if we pull it back to verse 35, we have one of the times where Jesus self-identifies, and he self-identifies with the divine feminine and says that Lady Wisdom or Sophia is known by her children. And if we put back one verse more to 34, it's in the context of Jesus being accused of being a party animal and a booze hound and hanging out with all the wrong people. Or as the NIV, which I happen to have open with me, the Son of Man came eating, drinking, and you say he is a glutton and a drunkard and a friend of tax collectors and sinners. And suddenly, your reading is actually framed around not just her self-understanding and her struggle, but Jesus's sense of vocation and his identification with like Lady Wisdom, Sophia, and actually, no, Jesus saying, look at the children I produce. They'll tell you who I am as a mother. And it's like, this is far spicier than the kind of puritanical reading of like, do we really appreciate forgiveness? Like, really?
Absolutely. And I think also one of the things, thank you for bringing that up, because one of the things that I was thinking of when reading this text is the fact that she shows up as a woman. I think the mention of her hair is really important, because in so many ways, you know, like there are so many rules about hair also in the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible. But also in our current moment, you know, there is a sense of what does hair mean? You know, and a lot of my work revolves around the idea of Latinidad, and which is just when people from Latin America or the Caribbean, depending on the country, come to the United States, they're suddenly just made Latinos, like on the, you know, on one click. And suddenly ethnicity and race just disappears off of the question, and there's just more of a monolithic interpretation of what a Latinx person is supposed to be or look like, or what language they're supposed to speak, which of course is the erasure of Black people, the erasure of Indigenous people, of Asian people, and everyone else, and even specifically actually of white Latinos, because they also get suddenly put in place as people of color, you know. But yeah, there is, I mean, I've heard stories of people who are white, you know, white Latin Americans who come to the United States, and it's for the first time that they're experiencing racism and marginalization and being placed in a position where their whiteness is not at the top because they're not considered the right kind of white person. You know, and so all of that is kind of like in the background for me when I'm reading the text. But specifically in Latin America, and in the Latinx community, there is that idea of good and bad hair. And you know, of course, like curly, kinky hair is bad hair. It's not professional. There is still, like, I remember, you know, in the research that I'm like working on right now, also, people will put out ads, you know, and say, like, in Latin America, they say, like, light skin or white, just simply but white, straight hair, as part of the of a job, you know, ad. So that's real, you know. And I'm like, this is 2025. And so, you know, kind of like exploring that idea of how valuable hair is, that it even was mentioned here, because it, she could have done it also with like with her garment, or in, she could have brought a towel, all those things, right? But with her hair, there, to me, there is something so private and personal about that. There is also a tenderness that she had towards Jesus, you know, like, I don't let strangers touch my hair. Sometimes I don't even let my friends touch my hair, you know. But it is a very private moment. But to me, it's also a showing of the trust that she had for Jesus in that moment. Because there also is, I wonder, you know, like, how would she have felt, or how would she have been received that Jesus had rejected her in that moment, you know? So there had to be like a level of trust to begin with that he wasn't going to do that, you know? That she could just sit there as herself in what they were considered to be her sin, quote unquote, you know? But she just shows up. And then uses her hair. And to me, that's just so beautiful and powerful, you know?
That bit, so there's, you got, my brain is firing. You got me firing all over and all cylinders. So there's a book, Religion of Whiteness, that came out. And one of the things it talks about is the sense that many Black people, the sociology, right? It's looking at white Christians engaging the exodus from white evangelical spaces and multicultural spaces after, you know, a lot of summer 2020 and all that. But they talked about the sense of betrayal that so many Black folk experienced in these white churches in these moments, almost probably imagining, like, when you were talking about Tamir, right, and what happened, like, how are people talking about these things? Because that could be me or my nephew or my niece or a loved one. And all of a sudden, there's this sense of betrayal that. So it's fascinating to hear you talk about, I mean, it's the risk of betrayal that was a possibility, right? But there was enough trust that even in the public square, within the midst of the stigma, that she went and did engage in a very intimate act with her hair in public with Jesus, in a way that was going against cultural context of that time, but was really profound and meaningful. And that does open up all kinds of intercultural questions for how that plays out, because it hair doesn't mean the exact same thing, but it has a lot of meaning, right? As you know, like, it has a lot of meaning. And that's wild, the stories that you're sharing of, you know, job posts that will be so explicitly, you know, colonized and white in its orientation and normative framing for the ideal person. I think that, it opens us up to think about the own sense of betrayal that we experience in these spaces as well, and the trust we need to have a soft space of liberative landing, right, where we can heal and be ourselves fully. I don't know, so much. I'll be chewing on that for a little while. That's the first time I've heard someone frame and emphasize the risk that she was taking in that particular way. Like, it was a risk, but I think that's pretty profound and helpful for us to kind of think through.
Very thought-provoking. And Carla, I'd love to hear, because in evangelical spaces they make a lot of the alabaster jar, and it's not that there isn't a lot there, but the lot that is made is sometimes a lot that doesn't connect to the conversations we've had so far. So I'd love to hear from you, what do you make of the alabaster jar, given how you come to see it through your own experience?
I think, well, yes, you know, the alabaster jar, people love to talk about that. You know, because it would have been considered expensive, all those things, right? But I, for me, the framing of that in my own life, I think has been that there are things about myself that I kept away from everybody, you know? There is a cost that comes with illegality, in very, like, real and everyday life, you know? My idea, like, the ideas of who I am, the ideas that I have learned from the church, the ideas that I have learned from society, all of that, in so many ways, I did internalize them, you know? And then, so when I look in the mirror and I see beauty, it's for me, it's one of the most radical acts I could have, because society says that's not true. The white evangelical church where I spent a lot of my, you know, a lot of my, well, for sure, like when I was a kid, but then also like my young adult life, also says that, right? Like I don't fit the idea of what a traditional quote unquote wife is, you know, the submissive idea. I was always in positions of leadership in church. So already there was like a power dynamic there, right? I remember one time asking somebody, a close friend, I said, hey, so is there something like just wrong with me? Because nobody has ever asked me in a date. This is like in my early 20s, you know? And he looked at me and he said, this is a white man also. And he looked at me, he said, no, it's just that men are terrified of you because you are in positions of leadership. You know who you are. And it was so interesting because I didn't know who I was. If I had known who I was, I wouldn't be there, you know? but you know, like, but that idea of like the submissive wife and the quiet, you know, all of that, all of those ideas were up in, you know, floating in at that time in my life. And so there were so many ways that I had to hold back who I really was, you know. Even in normal, like in, you know, like common spaces, like I remember in high school, you know, like at the time it was the iPod had just come out and so I had like 30 gigs of music and it was a combination of whatever, you know, everybody else was listening to. I was really into like 80s music for a while there, but secretly I would listen to Afro-Peruvian music on my way to school, you know, and it was like my ritual. I would miss home and I didn't know how to communicate that to anybody else. So I would just listen to Afro-Peruvian music. But then when the conversation came to, oh, what are your favorite musicians? I'd be like, Metallica. Sure. You know? And I mean, it was true also, but you know, but really what was like grounding me was Afro-Peruvian music, you know? And so I think of all the things that I kept to myself. I kept my hair to myself. I never used to wear my hair down. Now, you know, of course, like listeners can't see me, but I have long curly hair that's always down pretty much now. But I didn't do that until I was almost 27 years old. Wow. I always had my hair up because I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know. I just didn't understand it. And so I just always had it up. And, you know, so I think of that kind of thing. I think of the ways that I dress, the ways that I spoke. I mean, the music clearly that I listened to, because then when I became very evangelical, it was like all like, you know, Christian contemporary music. The ways that I knew, like, it was so funny. I remember being a listener of Hillsong in the United States before anybody even knew what Hillsong was here. Like, I would go, I would travel so far to see Hillsong because nobody knew they were, you know? So it was like that deep, you know?
All the way in.
Yeah, all the way in. And so I think it is like all these treasures, and that's like the, you know, like the, a lot of the outside world, but even inside of me, it was like, how do I use my voice, my language? I always had a lot of tension of like, what is my accent? What, you know, and I think I did that up a long time ago, but for a long time, when I first moved to the United States, I didn't speak. And so people just thought that I was very introverted and shy. I was not, turns out. and so I just didn't want to speak, you know, because of those tensions. And then also for a long time, I struggled, you know, like being, one of the things that happens when somebody's undocumented in this country is that education is, it's harder to access. Some things have changed here and there. There's a lot to be said about that. But For the most part, somebody who has no documentation is considered an international student if they are applying to a university in the United States. And so if tuition for a state university is $5K per year, it would be double, you know, and that doesn't include all the fees and housing and food, and you can't work, right? Like legally you can't work. So all of that is at play. Like I wasn't able to have a job until I was 23 years old. And so I never knew how to excuse that to people, you know, like I didn't know whether I should say, you know, like I can't work, but then that would raise a lot of questions. I couldn't drive, you know, so that would raise a lot of questions. All those things that come with, you know, with experiencing illegality. And then also, and I've written a poem about this before, but there was that like sense of my whole being illegal. And so what does that do to not only, not just the way that I carry myself, but what does that do to the soul? Where then it's like, is my love illegal? Is my laughter illegal? Is, you know, is my food, is the way that I care for people illegal? Because then that would raise the question of, should I not care for people then? But that didn't match with the ways that I understood Christ to be, in the ways that Christ loved people, in the ways that Christ cared for people. And that also, in finding more liberative theologies, I also, it was almost like for the first time I realized, oh, Jesus experienced, you know, such a deep level of oppression that I, in some ways, I find comforting. In other ways, I hold a lot of tension of what does it mean to worship an oppressed God, you know, and to love an oppressed God. And then, you know, so it, there's, you know, I'm a theologian, so in my brain, there's, it can't just be one or the other. But there's all of these things of who I am, right? Like my art is photography, anything, any, my imagination, is all of that illegal? And is this the gift that I just keep to myself? But what if I take the risk and pour that on the feet of Jesus? You know, what if I take who I really am and pour that at the feet of Jesus, you know, and say like, listen, I don't know anything. I got it wrong for a long time. You know, I thought I knew who you were, and I got it wrong. And so now, but I think this also brings in the question of community, because now if I think I get it wrong, or if I think I'm like, this is a little questionable, there are people I can call. There are people on this call that I can call, you know, and say, hey, I don't know about this. Can you help me process? Or can you, you know, because, and I think that matters. But there is that sense of, I can take the risk now in a different way, where I'm going to show up as my full self, and I'm, and just my being, like, I think of other lures, the personal is political and the political is personal. That is my life. It doesn't matter, like, if I show up anywhere, in romantic relationships and in familial relationships, it doesn't matter. My being is made political by the systems of oppression, and so it just is what it is. But it doesn't have to keep me ashamed. It doesn't have to keep me secret.
Yes,
I can break through. I can come into the room because Jesus is waiting there, you know?
Wow.
Carla, that's a word. Seriously.
Yeah. That's a word.
That's a word. And what it is with you to be invited into Jesus's illegality, even in this story, like particularly with the verses 34 and 35 kind of framing that Jesus is like pushing back and handing back projections. I'm not that kind of Messiah. Actually, here's my self-understanding. Lady Wisdom, Sophia, like that's how I understand myself. And that kind of framing right from the start, you imagine that at least some of the 12 disciples would be like, finally, an invite to a Pharisee's home. Here's a bit of respectability. Here's a powerful movement that have united our people under oppression. And we are mixing it with those who are a big deal, who actually hold some pride for our community. And by proximity, we're going to get in on some of like that self-regard, that self-esteem. And then this woman comes in the same situation that Jesus always finds himself and continually places himself in. And I can imagine the disciples just being like, oh, Jesus, you blew it. Like this was it, right? This was one of these moments. Carla, with the politics of respectability playing such an important role in many church spaces, I would love to hear a little bit what it looks like to be found with Jesus, in situations with those who, their legality, isn't a given. And in fact, what does solidarity, what is the kind of solidarity you hope for rather than trying to impress, the religious establishment, which has carved out some space for themselves?
I think honestly, I've been thinking a lot about what is my own role in movements of, organizing and activism and all those things. And the more I ask that question, the more I think of the details of the movement. And I think of even the women of the civil rights movement who are often kept secret. I think of the ways that the church, I can only speak for the American church, and I would say maybe Latin America too, but or Peru specifically, but like the church is ran by women, even if they're not on the pulpit. And so I think of the ways that we care for one another daily, because especially in the United States with what's happening, in recent history, community is a real thing, and I'm not speaking of just like let's meet once a week and like pretend that we're all okay for a day. But it is in the like it's in the like middle of the night, like, hey, I don't know what's going to happen to me, I don't know what will happen to my family. And like in the face of mass incarceration, of mass deportations, of all the ways that capitalism has continued to try to kill our souls. I think of the ways that we can show up in concrete ways where it's like, if somebody is sick, does this interrupt my day? Yes, but I will bring them a meal. And it sounds so like this isn't changing the system and this isn't going against the system. But I remember last year when all the encampments were happening at the universities, and even yesterday there was a oh my gosh, excuse me, an action that took place at Barnard, so right next door, and for me, did I show up to some of the protests and did I show up to the encampment and I spent time there? Yes. And I wanted to be the person who was able to care for those who had experienced that violence. There was a lot of police violence last year for a lot of students. And so I wanted to be one of the people who just was able to care for the after, right? Like after being in jail for 3 days, what do you do, And those are the things that sometimes get missed in the movement of solidarity, But I think of even, actually, I'm reading because I'm going to Selma in a few days. And I'm reading about the story of a 15-year-old girl, and she says, we had a plan. Some of us would go and march, and some of us would stay back and take tests for everybody else so that none of us were failing our math tests. And I just thought, this is so interesting.
That's awesome.
You know? Yes. And she says, you know, like they call him like the brain organizer or something like that. You know, it was like a, these were the people who were staying behind to learn for us, you know?
Yeah. I know which group I'd be in.
You know, but I also thought about the power of theology know, even on Tuesday. Yes, absolutely. Because I asked Dr. Mitri Rahab, you know, I said, you've been doing this for a long time. And you said, I mean, he said it himself, it was like over 30 years. Yeah. You know, and I said, that's a long time to explain to the Western world why this matters, you know? But it matters, you know, because now in this moment of time, we haven't seen a movement like this for Palestine ever, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, mm-hmm. So we talked a little bit about that but it would be different, right? Like if he was out in the streets, we wouldn't have all the work that he has done for 30 years, you know? Yeah. And so I really have been thinking about the roles of solidarity and what is, and it, I think it is connected to the thing that brings you life and the thing that connects to that call for justice, you know?
Yeah. 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 That's so good.
Howard Thurman again.
Yeah, Thurman, right? The genuine within. Well, I was thinking about Cohn. So I remember when I was in grad school for my PhD program, that's when Ferguson erupted.
Mm.
And so prior to that, like I had been pastoring for 10 years. I was doing anti-racism work. Like I was a practitioner and made a quite a significant turn. So all of a sudden, when all that was going on, like I remember I was studying for comprehensive exams in a library, tucked away, like grinding, thinking like, what am I doing? Right. I was really struggling. It was like this kind of vocational sense, like, what in the world am I doing? Is this like a waste of time? Should I even be here? And I remember coming across James Cone, right, as you're sitting there in Union, his writings, Risks of Faith, I think is the book that it was in, that he just briefly, it was just like a paragraph, just happened to mention, you know, that he also was in that exact same experience, and his brother Cecil was out in the streets, right, struggling, and he didn't know at the time, but he decided he was going to persist, and how grateful, like he felt like he made the right vocational calling to keep studying and writing and doing the theology on behalf of the movement that played a really important role for so many people, right? And so I can resonate with, yeah, I mean, there's just so many different ways that we can enter into and support and participate in this work. And I love the imagery. I mean, it fits so well with the passage you've chosen. I mean, the intimacy of her act, and you're talking about caring for people, right, in the midst of all that they're going through, and showing that kind of intimate mercy and compassion in the midst of it. Like, there's a whole entire community of ecosystems where everyone is needed, and to bring their full selves, to find the genuine within, right? And to show up fully in those spaces, that's really powerful. So yeah, thank you for that.
Thank you.
And Carla, I'm really impressed as well that you talked about, was it like the 3 days later when somebody has got out of lockup, and there is something very lonely about after the action, and people might be there to go, yay, here's some food and all the rest. And then there's working through the, and it's so, I think movements are getting better at doing that part of loving each other well, and moving from theologies of sacrifice and just how vital like that work is. It's vital that, you know, 15-year-olds don't fail their maths classes, and that shouldn't be undermined or feel like it's underrated. Carla, I feel like I could talk with you forever, and we do. So but I'm also aware, in terms of the podcast, we probably should land at some point. But were there any kind of final things that you wanted to say about this passage before I wouldn't want to cut off anything that was on your heart to share.
Yeah, I think for me, one of the invitations that I would have is to look at the way that Jesus treats women, you know, and the way that Jesus can hold all of who she is. He didn't ask her to be a different person before she showed up. He didn't say you have to wait here until you become this. And I think also because he barely actually speaks to her, you know, he speaks to the Pharisee more than her. But there's also, I think, a tenderness there where not everybody has to know what they had to talk about, right? Because we also don't get any more details. But the invitation, and specifically, would be to react with care and tenderness and love for Black women, for Black trans women. You know, there's a lot of dangers that we face as a community. There's erasure. There is a commodity of our bodies, of our cultures. And so, yeah, I feel like my invitation is actually, of course, like for Black women and for women, you know, to show up as ourselves, yes, and also to remember the tenderness, that is found in the ways that Jesus interacts with us.
I've loved, and every time in fact, I briefly talked about this passage in Trouble I've seen, but like the one, like the "Do you see this woman" phrase has always stuck out to me, right? And and the reason why this passage has always been really meaningful for me, and I think I've shared this before, like I had a professor. I grew up in a more patriarchal kind of church community where women, in many ways, had access to most things, but when it came to preaching and pastoring, it was completely off limits, right? And I took it for granted that it was just being biblical, right? That's just what I was taught. And so when I was in college, it was a Mennonite woman who was just teaching the Gospels to us. And it was this passage that really, I don't know, the Spirit of God just like opened me up as she was moving through the story and just telling the story and just highlighting how Jesus goes back and forth. She and you, she and you. I don't know why in that moment, literally that back and forth, it's like my heart softened. I could hear Jesus anew again in that moment. So it's been really powerful text for me in terms of seeing women anew in a way I hadn't before. Not that I didn't love, I always loved my mama, right? My sister, my nieces, my cousins, all of them. But to really recognize that I can grow and learn the way that Jesus highlights and centers her, right? This vulnerable woman, this stigmatized woman, is really centered as the inbreaking of God's kingdom here in this moment, in contrast to the very men who we'd expect to be the inbreaking of God's, the ones who many imagine are at the forefront of what God is doing are actually going counter to the way in life of Jesus Christ. And so I think that there's something really powerful about that. I appreciate the challenge and the invitation to center, learn from, grow from, and come alongside all women, but especially vulnerable women who've been stigmatized in our society.
Yeah, it's great, Drew. That line, "Simon, I have something to tell you." That's a great launching pad. Like, it's so loaded. It's so like how it sets the and like I imagine, is he looking at Simon, or is he like, does he have a half grin while he looks at her? Like, how much is she in on this joke? Like, at what stage does she realize that her risk of safety, the faith that has saved her, the risk that has healed her, is actually being delivered in her presence. Like, what point in that discussion? And I also just love that it is in the context of the dignity of those that others label actually finding who they are in the presence of Jesus, that that's where the discussion of forgiveness comes. It's not some abstract theological category to systematize somewhere. It's like, yes, it's eschatology. Forgiveness is always eschatology, and it breaks in when people feel their dignity. Here's forgiveness. Here's what it feels like. Here's what, and it's not merely for her, but Simon, I have something to tell you. And sometimes salvation doesn't feel like salvation until we turn and receive it as such. Sometimes it can feel like judgment of the systems that we're a part of. And I think there's an offer in that as well for those who don't find themselves on the underside, that our games of respectability and carving out spaces for ourselves because of the political realities can still find ways of oppressing others that aren't us. And that's really complex stuff to work through. But what a better place to do it than in Jesus' presence, right?
Well, so good, Carla. So good. Thank you so much for you are just such a gift. Your
Yes, you
story.
are.
We could have spent a lot more time on illegality because there's just so much there, right? There's that's a whole nother episode. But thank you for also just your lens on this text and what you offer us. I think it's timely, it's needed. For all of us to find our true humanity of who God is calling us to be, right? So, yeah, thank you so much for your time with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. You know, I love being with y'all.
Oh, we love you dearly.
The Inverse Podcast is proudly supported by you, the listener. And if you want to join the revolutionaries who are helping us have conversations about how this ancient text can still turn the world upside down, why don't you head over to patreon.com/inverse.